I need my end. Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. And we're coming to you today from our Cork studio. But can I assure you all that we are aware that the rest of the country has a limited tolerance for Cork people talking about how great Cork is. So we did 2 hours of that yesterday, so relatively normal service is resumed today. But we do have a Cork panel, so I can't guarantee that somebody won't try and slip in there how great Cork is. But let's see how we go. Now, the papers, the Business Post is leading with, there's a kind of a chill there. On the front of the Business Post, Intel workers to be told of potential job cuts in weeks. And of course, the five big tech companies, right, lost $1 trillion in their value last week, at a seventh of their value. I think Amazon lost 20% in one day. Meta is in free fall at this stage. And none of that bodes well for us and our reliance on tech, you would imagine. The Sunday Times, Hutch gang on the brink after informer jail. So they're saying in this story, John Mooney is saying that the collapse of the gang is being attributed to the imprisonment of John Murphy, the retired Garda superintendent. The Sunday Independent has that Jodie Corcoran is writing that Sinn Féin housing spokesman Eoin Óibrín has backtracked from his statement that the chief economist in the Department of Finance be sacked, but he says that the civil servant concerned should not continue to inform the government's housing policy. The Mail, a politician posed as a teen to groom me. This is allegations of online catfishing against an unnamed Irish politician. I'll just give you the tabloids for your entertainment. The Sun on Sunday, my son saved my life, Simon Cowell is saying. The son didn't literally like yank him out of a burning building, but he did save him from a dark obsession with work. The Star Sunday, Lettuce Liz hacked by Mad Vlad. So Wet Lettuce Liz Truss has had her phone hacked by Mad Vlad's Ruski spies, according to them. And the Mirror, Kerching of the Jungle, Boy George is going to be the highest paid ever person on I'm a Celebrity. He's getting £500,000 for his stint on the show, and good to see it. Good for Boy George. Our panel this morning, Seamus Coffey is a lecturer in economics in UCC. Deirdre O'Shaughnessy is the news editor of the Irish Examiner. Lorna Bogue is a councillor in Cork City and a former member of the Green Party. And Dr. Chris Luke is an Irish Medical Times columnist and a former consultant in emergency medicine. Good morning, everybody.
Morning.
Lorna, we're going to start with something. And again, people have limited tolerance for this, and they shouldn't, really. But in the Sunday Independent, cool reaction is damning as temperature rise passes tipping point, Caroline O'Doherty. It was extraordinary what happened this week, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was indeed. I suppose the really extraordinary thing is actually the reports that are going out.
Tell us first what was said by the UN and various other climate authorities,
yeah,
and then the reaction to it.
Yeah, so basically what the UN has said is that there is no credible pathway to 1.5 degrees. So that means that keeping our average global temperatures below that 1.5 degrees of warming is something that even the UN now is saying is not particularly possible.
So we're on track now for 2.5, it seems.
Yeah.
Which is catastrophic.
It is indeed. And I suppose the issue with all of this is, Caroline O'Doherty had a very good piece in The Independent about it. She tried to paint this scenario where governments would actually take it seriously. So an emergency meeting of the cabinet would happen, that all of these measures would be put in place, that people who are suffering from fuel poverty would be assisted. And of course, none of that has happened. The government, in fact, didn't make any statement about this extraordinary thing that has happened. And, you know, I know it's a bit of a downer for a Sunday morning to talk about, you know, this type of Mad Max type situation that's coming about. But I suppose there's a new story that has to be told about climate crisis, and it's something that is actually positive and something that people can do something about. We just need the political will to do so.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, even the, like, look, I don't want to get into media bashing, and the media does what it has to do. but the media coverage of it was not front page news. It was down the bottom of pages. You're nodding away there, Deirdre Shocknessy,
yeah,
as a member of the media.
Yeah. I mean, the people who make the decisions are people too, and we have the same reactions to this that the public have. And we're going, oh, another report. Okay, how big is this one compared to all the other big, terrible reports? And we don't know sometimes. You know, you're looking at it going, well, the UN have said it, the International Institute for whatever has said it. Like, I don't know which of these is more serious or which is worse. I think we all know the situation is really grave. We all know we're on this path. And as you say, Lorna, it's the political will. I mean, there are so many decisions that could have been made that would feed into both the fuel crisis that we have at the moment and the climate crisis to, for example, give everybody grants for solar panels. That didn't happen. You know, there's really basic things that actually could have been done. And as you say, there are positive things, you know.
I'll tell you something now, and it's possibly because I've been reading Greta Thunberg's new book. Like, a few solar panels on houses is not what we're talking about here. Seamus, it sounds as if really what's required here is to completely change how we live our lives and how our economies are structured and everything, like drastic kind of change that we're just not willing to do, are we? Even though, like they say, it's existential for us as a species.
Yeah, it's pretty clear that it has to be done, but I suppose it doesn't have to be done overnight. It can be achieved over it will be achieved over a pretty long period, like talking about changing how homes are heated, how our use of fuel, our transport, our means of production, etc. That can all change. It actually can, like, we have had huge shifts, like from whether it was from coal to electricity to other forms
of fuel.
Our
emissions are going up though, aren't they?
Yeah. And like globally they are, yes, because we're still using more coal, even though it might be an 18th or 19th century technology, it still is being used. And like it's hard to argue against countries that have lower living standards than us, that they shouldn't use something that in a sense benefited us 50, 60, 100 years ago. But I think our system can change, but we just can't expect it to happen overnight. Like when it comes to, say, retrofitting houses in Ireland, you're talking 2 million units. Okay, some of them have been built in the last number of years are up to standard, but many, many aren't. But even if you're doing a couple of like 10, 20,000 a year, you are making progress. So I think the change can happen. Evidence suggested it has to happen, but I don't think we can kind of try to get there too quick. But clearly something has to be done. If you're talking about solar panels, that's not it. Like, it is bigger than that. And if you take it in the wider world, the use of cars, like recent reports on Ireland shows that we have a high car dependency, but actually other countries have more cars than us. Their car ownership per capita is much higher. And even countries that we consider to have good public transport infrastructure, say like the Netherlands, which has good public transport infrastructure, good cycling infrastructure, they actually use cars more than we do. But they have the combination of those other sort of modes of transport that are available. So they also have to change. So it's not a case of build the cycle lanes and you've everything done. You actually have to get out of the car. And even the switch to electric cars, that's just replacing the combustion engine with another 2-ton piece of metal.
Chris Luke, you wouldn't be a complete stranger to psychology. What is going on with us that we don't want to know about this or grasp it or whatever?
I was just thinking about, I was giving a lecture last week about something parallel to this about, and quoting T.S. Eliot, who said, human beings can't take too much reality. Mm. And that is also this other issue, which is paralysis through analysis. There's so much analysis going on. There are so many headlines, as Deirdre suggests. And, you know, another thing is, I mean, I have four children and my youngest is a young man who is, you know, he's at the kind of, we're so doomed. He's got this nihilism, which I gather a lot of Gen Z have. So I'm delighted to hear.
Should we be listening to them?
We must listen to them, but they must remember that human beings can only digest a certain amount of horror story, you know, at a time.
Okay.
So I think I'm currently reading Regenesis by George Monbiot, and he spends the first 20% of the book scaring the bejesus out of you. And then, and quite rightly, spends the next 80% in telling encouraging tales from all around the world about individuals showing the way, which is what leadership is about. It's showing, exemplifying what needs to be done and inspiring and giving hope.
Yeah. So, Lorna, you can get, when you read these books, you can lose hope, really, and think we're never going to do what's required here. I mean, I kind of feel at the moment that the whole consumer economy as we know it, we kind of have to give up on a lot of that, do we?
Well, Chris is actually telling a very familiar tale to me, which is that I pick up one of these books about climate crisis, and normally I'll actually flip past the first 30% of the book because that describes, you know, the terrible situation that we're facing into. I'm interested in this idea more of hope and optimism around it because, you know, it's very difficult to report on just this never-ending cycle of, you know, frustration and not doing enough and all of this. I think we do actually need to see this from a different perspective. And it's not this idea that we're going to impoverish ourselves because of taking climate action. I mean, Seamus actually hit the nail on the head there, which is that, you know, we have moved from industrial systems that are based on water power to coal to oil. This is the next, I suppose, industrial development that has to happen. So either we're kind of behind on that as a country and we're not investing in it and we're not actually doing the things that we need to do, and we end up being, you know, left with a load of stranded assets and a load of stranded sectors that we currently have in the Irish economy. Or we actually decide to do something about it now and put the investment into that development, into that research and development that needs to happen. So I actually think that climate now, as someone who's been, you know, at this for 7 or 8 years now, it's a story of optimism, but, you know, it's the political will that has to change. And the political will that has to change is there has to be a desire to change the existing order of things as they are, you know.
And
that's
the Greens
the problem.
Are in government. Your
and
colleagues.
There's no statement coming out from the government about this, so it's fallen off the table.
Okay. Look, we could and should go on about that for the next 45 minutes, but let's move on to the economy that we do have at the moment. Anyway, we have it for now, Seamus. You picked that piece on the front of the Business Post I was referring to there, Intel workers to be told of potential job losses in weeks. Just, if you want to get into the specifics of that in a minute, what's your outlook now? Because I think there's terrible uncertainty out there and people would like to hear, I think they like to hear from economists how they see things panning out over the next year maybe.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a level of uncertainty there, I suppose. Like when it comes to making forecasts, like we know that all forecasts are going to be wrong. You're just going to have a kind of a view of, are they giving you insight into sort of the underlying conditions that are there? And clearly there are issues impacting the Irish economy at the moment. Obviously inflation, a lot of it coming from outside. It's not directly under our control. It's influenced by global energy prices, global food prices. And we see that the ECB reaction with increasing interest rates, and that's obviously going to have an impact of taking money out of some households' pockets because they've debts, they've loans to pay, and a higher interest cost is going to reduce their disposable income. So that will have an impact. But in the main, the economy is actually in a pretty strong position. We see employment growth quite high. We see income growth in aggregate and at individual level reasonably high. And there are sort of employment opportunities out there. So the economy is in a good position. And what you'd be looking for with significant risks is there something out there that can pull the rug out from under us? Like, it's not 2008. Back in 2008, obviously, we can see it in retrospect, but it was also pretty evident at the time that the economy was very heavily dependent on borrowing. That was driving a lot of economic activity. That's not the case now. In fact, in certain sectors, we'd like to probably see more borrowing if more new houses were being built and have more accommodation available. So it's hard to see, like, what is that big thing that could tip the thing over the edge? Yes, there are risks out there. We said the prices, the interest rates. But actually, in the main, one of the issues with the Irish economy is just how much money we're saving. There's been a huge surge in bank deposits, partly driven by COVID, when they stopped us going out and we couldn't spend money. Mm. We're seeing a bit of spending around Cork this weekend.
So does that mean that half the population maybe is reasonably insulated here?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. There's a big generational divide in Ireland between different groups. If you're talking, we don't have great insight into who is actually doing this saving. Like, we have 180 billion euro on deposit, most of it with the banks, most of it at close to zero interest rate, and it has been growing very, very rapidly. We don't have a great insight, but you'd imagine it's older households that own their homes and have their mortgages paid off, and they're in a position to build up these very, very significant deposits. Where at the other end of the scale, you probably have renters facing ever higher rents, possibly younger households that have recently taken out a mortgage, possibly seen those rates increase. Now, most recent mortgages have been at fixed rates, so at least they'll be insulated for a while. But it's unlikely that those households are building up huge amounts of deposits. And I think during the week we had work from the ESRI about assessing the impact of housing costs on Ireland, and they clearly point to a generational divide with high and growing housing costs for younger people, those in the private rental sector, and low and even falling housing costs for homeowners and those that have paid their mortgages outright. So I think in the main, for the economy, the outlook actually isn't that bad. There isn't that thing out there that would say, oh, if this happens, the whole thing is going to tip over the edge. But there are huge concerns out there for particular groups.
Yeah, okay. So basically, Deirdre, what I'm hearing there is that on the macro, things are fine, but it's how it's trickling down or not trickling down or how it breaks down. And we're back to, and it comes up here week in, week out, mm-hmm. is the generation gap we have here.
Yeah, 100%. And actually, it's really evident in the poll for the Business Post today, the Red Sea poll. I kind of remarked on it earlier. We were speaking outside about this. And 54% of Fine Gael voters have no concerns about the cost of living crisis, which I just thought was remarkable. Mm. So that's a huge... 54% of them do. So the other okay. 46...
So half don't.
Just, yeah.
Don't have no concerns.
Don't have... They're not... Their chief worry is not the cost of living. So that's your people saving the deposits, you know, and fair play to them. They're in a lucky position. But if you look at the other political parties, and particularly Sinn Féin, 74% of people who are inclined to vote for Sinn Féin, their chief worry is the cost of living crisis. I think we can extrapolate there. Those people are probably younger. They're probably renting. They're probably living in places where they can't afford the rent, not mind to buy a house. They're maybe more urban than rural, although the rental crisis is nearly as acute now in rural areas as it is in urban areas. 61% of Fianna Fáil voters, it's their chief concern. So I think you can actually map out the age groups and the kind of the class groups almost across those statistics quite easily. And it just shows you, like, 64% are saying they've little or no disposable income. That's across all the voters that they surveyed. They surveyed 1,004 people online in that Red Sea poll. And it's just, it's quite interesting when you see then, like, the Business Post piece is, it's very comprehensive, and they're saying, you know, we have an unprecedented number of people in emergency accommodation, 10,975. That obviously doesn't include the people who have come here as a result of the Russia's war in Ukraine. And we've had 20,000 home completions this year, which is actually very successful based on the last few years.
Yeah.
In fairness to Darragh O'Brien, I think when he kind of says, you know, he's delivering, something has been delivered, certainly.
Do you think, yeah?
Something has changed. I mean, it's, if you look at the years that Fine Gael were in government, they didn't build houses. It's not their priority. Fianna Fáil, whatever they say about things, you know, they can be slammed on the basis of that they're the party of developers and that they're this, they're that, the other. But their priority always has been building houses.
Would you agree with that, Lorna, that it feels like this is starting to go in the right direction? Something's moving here.
Well, I suppose the thing that can pull the rug out from the Irish economy is actually that cost of living crisis and the lack of housing, the lack of services. You know, I think that what we're probably going to start seeing, and we saw this during the week with the story of secondary schools, primary schools not being able to find substitute teachers to come in and do the work for them. I think we're going to see a lot of sectors where the workers will simply not be there. And that's going to exacerbate the existing problems that we have with our public services. And that means that less people are going to be happy to continue to live and work here and simply go somewhere else. So I think that's the thing that could result in a slowdown in the Irish economy. And I suppose that instability has systemically always been there. You know, you can't always predict what the next crisis is going to be. That's the problem with recessions. Yeah. It's always a surprise or a shock to the system.
Yeah, so we're jumping around a lot of things there. I want to check in with our economist. First, Seamus, on the last thing that Lorna said there, in terms of that we, on one hand, don't have enough people to take the jobs. So that's an economy that's almost too successful, but on the other hand, clearly one that's not working for a lot of people. So do jobs like teaching and stuff, and jobs that maybe younger people are tending to do they need to be higher paid? Like, is that the simple answer here?
Yeah, I suppose it's worth looking at. The crisis at the moment seems to be in second vision, as Lorna said. It does seem to be very much based in the large urban sectors. Again, because of the costs, people younger...
So housing at the root of everything.
Absolutely. People younger in their career are more likely to be renting. And if you have a flat wage scale right around the country and you can take a job in one part of the country where your housing costs are a half or even less than what you'd face in Dublin, obviously the job elsewhere outside of Dublin would be more attractive. One thing about the current issue with secondary schools is that we're going through a bit of a population surge at secondary school level. We had a peak in births in Ireland in 2008, 2009, around 75,000. They are now hitting 13, 14, 15, getting into secondary school. At the moment,
okay,
we're looking
so
at around...
a bulge
right there. So if you went back 7 or 8 years ago, you'd probably have seen this with primary schools. Now we're seeing it with secondary schools. Like, we're under 60,000 a year for births, and that'd be sort of the standard for Ireland. But back 15 years ago, it was 75,000. So that's obviously putting pressure on the secondary school system, and it's a bit temporary. So should we hire lots of permanent teachers? Clearly there's more teaching roles needed, but you might find if you hire a lot of permanent teachers, you could have an excess then in 7 or 8 years time when you get back down to the more 60,000 average. But I think where it is showing up the most is in the cities. If there are choices and opportunities for students, for young teachers, they're obviously not going to go to the place or be attracted to the place where the costs are just too excessive.
Chris, similar in medicine? Is it
well,
similar
I think the
story,
teaching thing is very similar to what's going on. going on in nursing and medicine. You know, yeah. Brendan, people, I mean, we hear tales of lots of young teachers from Ireland going off to the UAE and so on, in the same way as our nurses are going to the UK and our young doctors are heading off to Australia. And I think it's a mixture of the terms and conditions that they face in, you know, in Ireland, and also the attractiveness of a lifestyle for a few years down under or across the water, where they're paid more and they're treated better. So I think there's a mixture of that. The other thing is I sometimes wonder, you know, when I hear the word growth, I sometimes think of tumour. You know, as well as the economy. Mm. And I would be sympathetic towards the idea that too much growth has driven us into, you know, the climate issue that we have. And you talked earlier about Boy George. I mean, we kind of laugh at, I mean, I love Boy George. He's of my era. But he is taking a trip right around the world at vast expense. And he's doing what I was saying about leadership. He's exemplifying precisely what we shouldn't be doing, which is flying halfway around the world. We have to reduce emissions. As far as I can understand from my recent reading, is that it's emissions as much as renewable energy. So we have to stop what we're doing, travel less, fly less, spend less, and so on. In other words, we need to understand that too much growth can be hazardous.
Yeah, so it all links into one big, I think, what do we call this? A poly crisis, isn't it, Seamus? A new word for this. Yeah. Seamus, can I go back to you on the housing? Because this is an area that you take an interest in, I know. Going back to what Deirdre was saying there about 20,000 houses this year, that it's not bad, that maybe there's a sense that something is turning here. Are we into this too will pass? Possibly?
Yeah, so there's no doubt that the recent housing completion figures were positive. Like, so you're talking 20,000 in the first three quarters of this year. In fact, quarter three alone, the third quarter this year was bigger than the whole year of 2013 and 2014. So more in 3 months than we were doing in 12 months, 7 or 8 years ago. So that is a positive. And we will probably hit for 27 or 28,000 this year, which would be the highest in a good few years. But I think some of the leading indicators aren't as positive. For houses to be completed, they must be started. And the Department of Housing collects commencement data. Okay. And you can look at the number of units being started. And that's actually been falling and falling for 4 or 5 months now. So while, yes, you have a pipeline coming through, and that is positive that completions are up. If we take what could be happening in 12 or 18 months' time, it looks like they're trending down again. And some of the indications is that existing schemes are being finished, but there's been a slowdown in the starting of new schemes. So I think, yes, we can look at the completions data and say, yes, that's a good thing. But I think, unfortunately, if you look out over the next 12 or 18 months, it doesn't look like it's going to be maintained.
And does the government ultimately, we saw, like, obviously, there's people like Rory Hearn and everything argue for the state building company, which you'd wonder one way or another how successful that might be. We saw on the front of the Mail last week this suggestion that the government might now come in and take over planning permissions and schemes that vulture funds were letting go. Is that something that could be a good idea?
There's not as a significant role for the state to be doing. Like, we have a housing system. We don't have a housing market, and the public and social housing system is very important in that. Now, the state is very active, and it is adding to the social housing stock, either directly itself through local authorities, getting units built. Like, they're not building the units directly themselves, but they are hiring in builders to finish out developments for them. Also, the approved housing bodies, they're adding significantly to their stock. So yes, the social housing stock is growing, but I suppose the public sector, the government is also, I suppose, interfering, you could say, in other parts of the housing system through the HAP and the rental accommodation scheme that are, in a sense, competing with the private tenants. And when we talk about those suffering the most due to Ireland's housing crisis being those in the private rental sector, yet they're possibly the group getting the least support. We're talking about rents rising very, very rapidly, supply being very, very low. Like, you go onto the housing websites, there are good listings, a good number of listings of housings available for sale. So you can go and view houses to buy. But if you're looking to rent, you're looking to get a reply. You're looking to see anything. Yet we seem to have the view that the focus should be on purely the social housing and purely home ownership. We're actually the group that are struggling the most are those that are trying to rent. Yes, renting.
And we have a rent bubble, so we should be trying to get them out of that and into ownership, like, shouldn't we?
And to some extent, that's happening. Like, if we talk about landlords that seem to be leaving the private rental sector, those houses are being bought not necessarily by landlords replacing them, but by owner-occupiers. We talk about the houses being built, 20,000. Many of those are going to owner-occupiers, and increases in the social housing. The sector where the squeeze is at the most acute is in the private rental sector. Yet we introduce rules that say, oh, you can't bulk buy schemes of houses for rent. They have to go to owner-occupiers. But why are we, like, favouring one group that have options out there versus another group who don't have any options at all? So it does seem quite perverse. But when it comes to the housing system, there is a strong role for the state. There's no doubt. you can't dispute that. We do need social and public housing.
And the state are taking a strong role at the moment.
And just have to keep going.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, we're normally up in Dublin and we hear a lot of the examples we tend to hear, and in the national media as well, of property prices and situations and everything tend to be Dublin focused. Lorna or Deirdre, could you Deirdre maybe tell us a bit about Cork and the scene here?
It's like the numbers aren't as startling as they are in Dublin, obviously just because of scale, but we had a story this week, my colleague Eimear McCauley worked on it, of I think it was six international students, international people who had come here. So they were working, some of them were English language students, some of them were working, and they had met each other. They were all from Spanish speaking countries. They'd met each other in Sheila hostel where they are all living, which is a perfectly nice hostel. They serve the tourism market. They found themselves, I think, more and more serving homeless people, people at risk of homelessness. And these kids, they're in their early 20s, they've come over here for a better life. The wages are four or five times what they are in Spain. They've all found work. They found, you know, they're working away. They are this weekend they were planning on sleeping in the airport because they couldn't afford a bed anywhere in the city. Their hostel booking is week by week, and obviously the jazz weekend was booked up months ago. They were going to be forced to sleep in the airport or in a car or on somebody's floor, a workmate or something. And they were literally still trying to figure that out on Wednesday or Thursday when she spoke to them.
Working people.
And that is happening all the time in Cork. It is like those hostels are now full of people who are working. We've had loads and loads of international students featured in the paper over the last year or so who have come here. You know, they've got their course, they've paid for it up front a lot of the time, and they're coming here and there's literally nothing. We've had people being scammed. We've had Anne Murphy has done a lot of work on the sex for rent stuff. That's been happening in Cork. It's been happening in rural County Limerick. It's been happening all over the country. So it's really no longer a matter of just Dublin. But I think obviously Dublin gets more attention because the numbers are bigger. But the problem is now that, I mean, when I was working local radio 5 or 6 years ago, people would ring in and say, like, if we had somebody on the show who was at risk of homelessness, people would ring in and say, oh, I've my mother's house in Mallow and it's empty and, you know, I'll hook up with them.
So there was a pressure release valve there.
And that is gone.
Yeah. Chris, are you still engaged in seeing what's going on in communities
I keep an eye across what's going on. And I have to say, I heard a very nice quote from Owen McGee talking to Claire Byrne earlier in the week when he said that sleep is more important than money. And basically, if you're in trouble with money and it's disrupting your sleep, then you've got to sort out that problem. That's how you determine the priority. For example, if you want to change your mortgage. Yeah.
Stress levels are
up through the roof. And yeah. I sometimes wonder, why don't we do what they did after the Second World War in the UK, and which they did in the 50s, you know, build modular homes, as was mentioned somewhere in the papers today. You know, we tackle COVID by a kind of a mobilisation of the whole nation. I think we have a similar challenge with health. You know, people's health depends on accommodation.
Is talking about that in your today.
But accommodation is one of the greatest requirements of human beings to live healthily and safely.
So this requires the kind of urgency we brought to COVID.
Precisely.
And of course, you go back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, the climate probably does as well, but they're both viewed as in some way like they're not urgent at the moment kind of thing. It's like pushing it out there a bit. Yeah. Listen, before we break, there's two things that I know, Lorna, you wanted to acknowledge. We're not going to get into rehashing the abortion debate today, and we're not really set up for it or anything. But you did want to acknowledge 10 years since the death of Savita Halappanavar, which was a huge catalyst for change in this country.
Yeah, well, I was at the very first vigil that happened outside the Dáil, you know, we were having a vigil yesterday outside the Crawford Art Gallery. And it was just amazing that so much time has passed, yet it doesn't seem as though that much has passed. And, you know, we're having this vigil for Savita Halappanavar, who died at 31, you know, and yet in the news this week, of course, is the death of Lindsay Bennett at 34, you know.
Yeah, and which is a very different
very, very
story,
different, but it's another young woman caught up in problems in the healthcare system, you know. And it's just, I remember very vividly outside the Dáil, the feeling was palpable that day, which was that we don't want this to happen again to another young woman. And you know.
And again, Lindsay Bennett is a very, very different story to Savita Halappanavar, but
yeah.
I see a young mother like that.
It's tragic. I mean, and I think with the cervical check campaigners, there's this really interesting space that they occupy in the national psyche. You know, they're like somebody we all know. I mean, Vicky Phelan, we were kind of saying the other day, has Vicky Phelan said anything? Is she well enough to say anything? Yeah. And of course, she was in hospital on the day of it. And we're kind of watching and waiting with them all and kind of urging them on. And when you see like another young woman, we had Emma Vic-Vahuna and now we have Lindsay, and of course Elaine Flannery died earlier this week. She had died and the court case was on earlier this week, and the reverberations of the cervical check scandal just keep going. And as you say, it is very different, but it is as a woman looking at these time and time again, these women dying, and you're looking at it going, why does this keep happening? You know, it's so difficult. But looking at the Savita Halappanavar vigils this week, I was really struck by Lorna has quite a different view of it to me. I was struck by how far we've come in 10 years. And yes, there is further to go. But I was at, again, one of the early vigils outside Cork Opera House 10 years ago. And, at the time of the referendum, I was pregnant with my second child. And I just remember the overwhelming feeling of relief. And I remember having the discussions with my parents, you know, when I was pregnant with my first son. My mother would have been very, very traditional and in those respects. And I remember saying to her, like, if anything happens to me, I said, it's not me, I won't get saved. And I remember her kind of really thinking about it then and going, oh. And by the time of the second referendum, I kind of said, oh, thank God, you know. And
okay. Look, there's huge shades of opinion on that issue, Chris. And on the cervical check, has a lot of good come out of
I come from a slightly different angle. I have three daughters, Brendan, three adult daughters. So I'm very much in favour of the new legislation, the access to abortion. I've been working with the HSC and one of the quality control committees of the last few years, and I've had a bird's eye view of the whole system. So precisely as Deirdre just said, it's really important every now and again that we look back to see where we've come. The further back you look, the further forward you can see. We've made huge progress. I have major anxieties about the viability of our screening services because of the loss of confidence in the doctors and staff that are providing those services, whether it's cervical or breast. And I've seen it from both sides. So yes, we need access. Yeah. Yes, we need availability and all of that. But I sometimes worry that we forget the humanity of the staff trying to provide these services, who are themselves trying to drive forward the innovation and the progress. And we've made a lot of progress. But I really worry about the viability of the service, because there's been a collapse in confidence on the part of doctors applying for these posts, for example, screening radiologists, because of the risks of them ending up in court. I mean, there's been suggestions that some of these screening radiologists and other histopathologists could end up in court almost every week of their careers if they took up the posts.
Yeah, but equally, people do have an absolute right to expect something of these services.
Absolutely. And they have an absolute absolutely. Right. I think it's really important to understand the nuances.
Absolutely. And look, nuances in both those stories, but I think we got a across the board view of them all there. Deirdre, really briefly, you're going to just give us the gist of the Business Post Red Sea poll today.
Yeah, it's the Red Sea poll. So the Sinn Féin are at 35%, which is the same as in the last poll in May. Fine Gael are at 21, they're up 3. Fianna Fáil, 16, down 1. Independent candidates are at 11%, which is down 1. The Greens are at 4%, down 1. Social Democrats at 4%, which is the same as they were on the last poll. Labour the same as well, 4%. People Before Profit Solidarity on 3%, so they haven't changed either. A&2 are on 1%, down 1%, and Other Party is on 1%, which is up 1%. So interesting enough, they're kind of saying Sinn Féin are still topping the poll despite the negative coverage, but Fine Gael have clawed back some ground, kind of suggesting that Fianna Fáil TDs, who felt the Fianna Fáil stamp was on all over the budget, kind of won't be too impressed with that they won't feel they've gained anything from it.
Yeah. And there was a suggestion in the Irish Times poll during the week that there was a little bit more of a bounce than that. And just as we said earlier, that was a random sample of 1,004 adults online between Friday, October 21st and Thursday, October 27th. So it was taken over the course of a whole week. Now, we're going to go to South Korea now. So far, we know that 150 people were killed in a stampede at a Halloween event in the South Korean city of Seoul. And South Korea's president has promised a full investigation into one of the country's worst disasters ever. Joining us from there is journalist Rafael Rashid. If you put on your headphones, guys. Good morning, Rafael.
Good evening from Seoul.
And I understand you were very near the stampede when it happened, Raphael.
Yeah, I was a few dozen meters away from it when it happened. I was out with friends, like many other people, going to have a good time on a Saturday night, and it was Halloween night. So, of course, there were many people out. But I think yesterday there were more people than I've ever seen before in this nightlife district known as Itaewon.
Okay.
But actually, I don't think any of us knew that anything wrong was going on. But it was about 10:20 or 10:30 p.m. When ambulances and fire brigades started to try to pierce through the crowds to go somewhere next to the station where I was. But it was very difficult for them to get through. And then police started shouting and screaming, like begging people, just leave the area now, please go away now.
Raphael, so can you describe the area where it happened?
Upsetting.
I'm sure. Can you describe the area where it happened? And then can you give us what we know about what actually happened in the area and the particular kind of geography of that street?
Yeah, so it happened in Itaewon, which is known as a popular nightlife district in Seoul. And it's very popular for young people to go out, especially at the weekend. But to access, I would say, all the big bars and clubs, you need to go through one of several small alleyways. And this is a street that I've been down many times. But no one could have imagined that something on this scale could happen in this tiny street where people got crushed to death. We know that people were trying to get in and get out of this small street. There are multiple eyewitness accounts as to what exactly happened, and it's still not clear, but it is emerging that many people fell on the floor and were basically crushed. And as people were entering and trying to exit this small street, it just got worse. And now I think the latest death toll is 153 people confirmed dead so far. And this is basically has become a national tragedy.
Yeah. How are people reacting to it in Korea?
Just absolute shock and disbelief. Obviously, no one could have predicted this was going to happen. And on this scale, this was meant to be a night of kind of festivities or you know, fun and excitement, especially having been under COVID for so long and the restrictions finally being lifted recently. This was the first kind of big a party night event since COVID restrictions were lifted, and everyone was there to have a good time and meet their friends. But it turned out to become an absolute disaster.
It's absolutely unthinkable. Okay, Raphael Rashid, thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Thanks. And look, guys, we'll leave that there. I don't think any of us have anything to add to that, but that is that's horrific. Now, the other issue, I suppose, that's been around all week, and it feels like this conversation is kind of getting slightly out of control in different ways and veering off in different directions and everything. And this is the conversation around Ukrainian refugees and the accommodation of them and everything. Lorna, you picked, and Seamus, you did too, but if I come to you first, Lorna, you picked that Hugh O'Connell's piece in the Sunday Independent as Winter Bites. Is our goodwill cooling too?
Yes, I did indeed. I suppose it's an issue that is arising in my own ward at the moment as well, because there's modular housing that's planned for Mahon, and there's a lot of disinformation running around about that as well. And
from would you say elements in the locality?
Not in the locality.
Okay, elements from outside the locality.
Yes, because I haven't seen these people before, you know.
Okay. So, and they're on local WhatsApp groups, Facebook groups, that kind of thing, is it?
Yeah, okay. Well, it's a delicate one to talk about, because you see, it's quite a nuanced discussion. you know. And the issue, I suppose, with all of these various refugee crises, I was trying to think of a different word to crisis, because everything is a crisis, mm-hmm. you know. These things lay bare, I suppose, issues that already exist within the Irish state, you know. So there's already an issue with housing. There's already an issue with lack of resources, lack of teachers in schools. Mahon, for example, doesn't have a library in it. And that's something that's been mooted for years and years. There's a street on it, Avenue de Ren, that has a community centre on it, but also is something that has not been resolved over a long period of time. And the actual construction of Mahon as a suburb was to take a lot of people out of the city centre and just put them out in the middle of what was at the time middle of nowhere, you know.
Yeah.
I suppose when people bring up these systemic issues, rightly so, and it's being surfaced by an issue of refugees coming in. I think that there are elements out there that seize on this and then turn it into something that it isn't, you know.
Yeah.
So that's a difficulty yeah. here. And I suppose with regards to this particular story, you know, the main thing that's coming across in this piece from Hugh O'Connell is that, you know, this was predicted, you know, it was predicted that there would be, you know, issues with integration because the services are not there. And this is further elided then in a story in the Sunday Business Post by Donal McNamee and Daniel Murray on the same issue, which is scramble to find rooms for refugees as system strains. And basically there's been a report sitting with the relevant department for 6 months from the Housing Commission that basically said that instead of you know, putting people out in the middle of nowhere, that actually what they should be doing is refurbishing vacant homes, because that puts people yeah. into the middle of the community.
And that this offers a far timelier prospect of realisation by comparison with new builds or other solutions, is what they said. And Seamus, you picked a piece in the Sunday Times, hundreds of homes are still awaiting Ukrainian refugees. This is by Bo Donnelly and Patrick O'Donoghue.
Yeah, I suppose it kind of highlights the approach taken to date with accommodating the Ukrainian refugees has made extensive use of hotels. And you can understand why that would be the case, that they're large, you can deal with significant numbers of people. They, in a sense, are designed to accommodate people, although not over the long term, clearly. And you can do the assessment and the checks much quicker, whereas doing it by individual properties obviously takes longer. But there are properties out there where people have either offered them cohabiting or vacant properties they have themselves that would offer some additional spaces. Now, maybe as Lorna suggests, it's not going to be enough, and additional housing is probably needed. But I think
nothing on its own is going to be
yeah,
enough.
So it's to put it all together. Yeah. So up to now,
they have accepted now maybe that the system for matching people with houses was not ideal, and it does look like they are trying to kind of streamline that system.
Yeah, like
more,
trying to do things like in the best or the perfect fashion when you're in an emergency situation like this, it is quite difficult. Obviously there are concerns, and you don't want to be placing people in accommodation that is either unsuitable or with unsuitable people, so you do have to make certain checks, but you can't have it taking too long and can't have it be overly cumbersome. And I suppose that is why they've gone for the hotel approach up to now, and that it does streamline a lot of elements. But now once we reach capacity there, you have to go to the next stage, and you say it has to be a combination of things. And like we talk about Ireland being in a housing crisis, but being in a war zone and being in a country under attack is far worse than being in a housing crisis. So in terms of Ireland's ability and willingness to accommodate people, remember we're mainly dealing with women and their children and perhaps some older people. Many of the men are actually in the conflict
zone.
Yeah,
but there seems to be an increase in men now, I think.
Many, yeah, not all, yeah, many, yes.
In this second wave, yeah. Chris?
Yeah, well, I don't think I have much more to add other than I think accommodation is, as I say, one of the most primary requirements of human beings. And I still would suggest that, you know, we need to be doing modular building and you know, using, you know, stadia and school halls and
yeah,
so forth.
And I think there is talk of school halls now, and there's talk of some parts of Croke Park and stuff. Deirdre?
Yeah, we offered a room to the Red Cross in March, and we were Garda vetted, somebody interviewed us for Garda vetting, and we have never heard another thing.
Okay, so when were you vetted?
May.
Do you think you failed the vetting?
Must have done. Yeah. My past has finally caught up with me.
Did you try and get onto them?
Yeah, now our circumstances changed. My mother passed away in the time, so okay, in the summer it wouldn't have been good. But now we're kind of saying, okay, we need to get back on this.
Yeah. And actually, it seems like you're putting out a fresh call now, though. It sounds like they're going, let's scratch, ground zero again, let everybody get back on.
But when you get back into the granular details of it, a couple of my colleagues, Jack White and Conor Kaplis, are working on this all week, and they got the stats from the department about how many have been housed, how many have refused housing, all that kind of stuff, and how many people's properties were found to be unsuitable. And there's huge gaps in the numbers because they just don't know a lot of the time what happened. Like, even now, they're saying that the local authorities have been given the responsibility for this. So the Red Cross are saying that. Some of the local authorities are saying, yeah, this is our responsibility. Others, all the deals negotiated by the different local authorities are different. So some of them have full responsibility for it, maybe three or four of them. Some of them only are responsible for inspecting the houses, but they don't take it any further. And I don't think anybody is joining the dots. It just seems to be really all over the place. And again, you're in an emergency. There's a level of that that's totally understandable. I mean, none of these systems were designed for this. But at this point, there were calls in the summer, I think, for a minister to be appointed to coordinate this. And I think actually that would have been a really good idea. Because at this point,
I suppose Roderick O'Gorman has ended up holding.
But he has so much else on his plate, you know. I just don't think it's feasible.
It does seem now, though, that we're saying, okay, that was the emergency. We're now into a medium term thing.
But they're saying now that, you know, the Red Cross don't have a specific role in housing people, but they can keep on with it if they want to. What kind of a response is that? Mm. That doesn't make sense. You know, you've Helping Irish Hosts, which is a voluntary organisation made up of
Who seem to be doing great work.
Who seem to be doing great work. Yeah. Like, if you look at their website, they have all these fact sheets and information, everything, which you can't find anywhere else. So there is a lot to ask from the official response. But I suppose, again, in an emergency situation, you do, to an extent, have to rely on goodwill and on people, you know, putting themselves forward and volunteering for things. That is happening as well, and that should be welcomed. But it does need to be streamlined.
But see, I suppose that's why I'm kind of looking at this story, and it's not people's goodwill that is the problem. Like, it's actually generally never people's goodwill is the problem. Like, I think that Irish people, we have kind of an outsized cultural space in the world. We always want to go further and do more than what people in general, you know, would expect us to do. So I find people in general are very happy to do that. But the problem is that this stuff is not a surprise. Like, geopolitical situations are not a surprise. We're 12 years after the Syrian war, where there was a similar intake of refugees. And there's nothing.
I don't think we ever took any numbers anywhere near this from Syria. We took a few thousand.
But you know, I suppose in terms of like asking people to engage in things, asking people to bring people into their communities, I think there's many communities across Ireland where there are still people from Syria who are integrated into the community, and that's the goodwill of the people. Yeah. But you know, it's just that every single time there seems to be just this refugee policy that is essentially run for hoteliers and isn't necessarily run by the state to be prepared for these things happening.
I don't think it's run for the hoteliers, and I think in fairness a lot of the hoteliers are going to be very glad to get out of these arrangements as the springtime comes, and that's not going to be ideal either, because I think they are relying on hotels. Moving on to something else, Chris, this was a massive talking point for people all week, and it, in a way, it's a source of entertainment, but in a way it is important as well. So Barry J. White in the Business Post is writing about Elon Musk's planned takeover of Twitter. They've got Paul Tweed, the notorious, infamous, famous libel lawyer, is raising the alarm over Musk's planned Twitter free-for-all.
Yeah, I mean, he's suggesting that, you know, the fact that Musk has finally bought Twitter after months of delay and confusion, it is going to be a Twitter free-for-all, you know, as perhaps, you know, demonstrated by ex-President Trump's enthusiasm on hearing the news that
yeah, he's still not back in, though.
No, he's not. Yeah. And, of course,
there seems to be a committee now being set.
Exactly. Musk has announced the appointment of a panel of very disparate people. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, something has to be done. I mean, anti-social media is a huge issue globally, and whether it's young people taking their lives because of bullying online, or whether it's, you know, pylons on Twitter,
And it seems to be connected with a massive rise in mental health problems among young people.
Absolutely.
It's certainly contemporaneous with it. Like,
I mean, I think anti-social media, particularly the anonymity aspect of anti-social, you know, commentary or pylons on social social media is driving a huge amount of mental health issues. Things like sextortion, cyber crime, scams, all sorts of things. And I think that I sense that Brussels, the EU, is driving forward in terms of, you know, insisting that there are far more fetters on the tech billionaires that own social media. But I think it's way past time that there were regulations.
Yeah. No, it should be said, Seamus, that Elon Musk, now, in fairness, he was talking to advertisers in this particular tweet, was much more sane than a lot of his other ones. And he said it will that Twitter will be cognizant of the laws of the land in all the countries and everything. It's not going to be a free-for-all. You're a big Twitter user, aren't you?
I'd use it, yes.
Yeah,
And it's hard to know what this change will bring about. Clearly, he had some motivation for at least initially making the offer to purchase the company. And then
I think he'd have picked it up a lot cheaper now, would he, than the price he agreed 6 months
ago. Well, given the
ago.
Last week and what's as you went through at the start, like some of the big tech companies have seen very significant share price losses in the last while. Now, they're still at very high levels, but nowhere near the peaks they were. But like, it's interesting to watch what's happening. Like, he's only in a week. It seems that there's been already changed at management level. There's reports of people have been forced to leave the company. We haven't yet seen changes in sort of the operation and on the platform itself, but clearly he has something in mind. And I suppose it does bear out like some of the long-term viability of it. He has entered very significant financial obligations. Like, I think the total sum is $44 billion. Like, he didn't pay that up in cash. He borrowed a lot of it. He put up certain amounts of collateral. Yeah. And Twitter as a platform, it's not hugely profitable. It does generate some revenue. Like, you spoke about advertising, and there is maybe a growing presence of promoted tweets and advertising on the platform. But it's not advertising the same way that Google does.
It's more influential than it's making money, isn't it?
Yes.
And it looks like the Google ad model is broken now as well. So really, if Musk pulls this one out of the bag now, it'll be his greatest achievement ever, because it looks like the wrong deal at the wrong time.
Agreed.
Okay, just a few texts before we finish up. We've been texting on all kinds of things. Somebody saying, Brendan, is Ireland now a developer's heaven? Endless demand, limited supply, concrete jungle. Here we go. That's from Con in Dublin. But the developers are saying they can't make any money either, Con. Someone saying here, is there a limit to the numbers we can manage safely and practically given our own problems? Ireland already has a higher per capita number of Ukrainian refugees. We're higher per capita than some countries and we're much lower than other countries. And another texter saying, listening to the conversation about Savita, important to say, not everyone agrees with abortion, but terribly sad to lose a young woman. And absolutely, and I think we reflected that in the conversation, that the people have lots of different opinions on these things and they are all entitled to their opinion. So look, that's it from our panel of Blow-ins in Cork, Seamus Coffey, Deirdre O'Shaughnessy, Lorna Bogue and Dr. Chris Luke. Thank you all very much for joining us today and for that very lively hour.